You will not believe what they are going to do to North Nashville.
A highway ripped through the heart of this historically Black neighborhood.
All the houses, they were all torn down.
They were all gone. It changed everything.
But the community's elders stood their ground.
This is their story.
This is We Are North Nashville. I'm Andrea Tudhope.
And I'm Simone Boyd.
And we're the hosts of the podcast We Are North Nashville.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, there's one.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
Did you really think this out?
Hi.
I mean, there's no rhyme or reason.
It's just, I don't know.
Okay, you with me?
Welcome to Essential Salt from Maine Public Radio. I'm Jess Miller.
What, do you have a list of the stories that are on
Here, I have some in front of me. Okay, so I'm sitting with Isaac Kestenbaum. He's the director of the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies in Portland, Maine.
Oh, these are all so good.
Isaac and I teamed up to bring you a collection of some of our favorite stories about Maine. Stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It can be really refreshing when you hear something like, you know, like a salt story.
For those of you who haven't heard of SALT, it's a documentary storytelling program at the Maine College of Art and Design. All the reporting is done right here in Maine, and the goal is to not only report stories about Maine, but to capture the truth of what it's like to live and work here.
A lot of these can seem like they're about something very small, you know? Like you really like narrow your focus in with these stories on like this one person or this one relationship or this one town. You know, you're looking at a really small thing, but it's a lens to view something really, really big.
When I focus on what I love about this state, all these really small things about life in Maine jump out at me. I love that after work, I can be at the beach in 15 minutes for a swim in the beautiful, horrible, freezing cold ocean. I love that fish and strawberries and carrots and potatoes taste alive when you eat them here, like dirt, like food. I love the many artists of Maine who, instead of painting lighthouses and mountains, make weird short films and ceramic installations and challenge the idea of who a Mainer is. And I love that when my neighbor across the street sees that I'm snowed in, he offers me his ice pick to help break up the end of my driveway. I really don't love having to use this ice pick, but I do love that there is community here. All these small things add up to something very big, and that is belonging. Maine is an amazing, unique place, and I have a theory about it. Somebody once told me, if it happens here in Maine, you're going to see it happening everywhere else. And that's really true. Here at the far northeastern edge of America, I somehow feel closer than ever to the biggest issues facing communities all across the country. So it kind of surprises me that so many people, especially people who love Maine, fans of Maine but don't live here, tend to have this picture in their head of a place that's like lighthouses and lobsters and,
you know, top 10 foliage drives.
Isaac says growing up, he kind of just tuned this glossy version of life out. Like, yeah, of course Maine is gorgeous, but there's so much more to this place. Then one day, back in the 1990s, Isaac was walking by a rack of magazines when something caught his eye.
It's like gritty black and white photo.
Asphalt and chain link fencing, kids playing in Portland.
It's like, where did this come from?
This thing he had found was a copy of SALT magazine.
It's sort of like, what is this? And kind of leafing through it and being like, this is the Maine that I know.
That's why local reporting is so important. When we see a place more fully, we understand it better. We ask more questions, imagine bigger possibilities. This kind of storytelling is powerful. It can give us a chance to see ourselves and the people we make our home with in a new way. And that's what we're inviting you to do in this show. We've chosen 12 stories that zoom in on voices and experiences around Maine. We'll hear people wrestling with their pasts and futures, and what it means to try to meet the moment as it happens. Okay, so ready? We're going to start with a story by Anissa Vitsa, reported in the fall of 2023. It's part mystery story, part love story, and I'm guessing if you've spent time in Portland, it's one that will find a special place in your heart.
When Sierra Farman was in elementary school, Valentine's Day was a big deal.
We decorated shoeboxes. We'd personalize all of our mailboxes, and then we'd go around to each other's desks, and we would put the Valentines in each other's box.
Every year, Sierra would go to bed the night before Valentine's Day, knowing that while she was sleeping, the Valentine's Bandit would strike, covering every doorway, window, and telephone pole in the whole city of Portland, Maine, in red paper hearts.
It's really beautiful. Everything by that point is white or brown from the dirt and the snow, and it's cold and often rainy and just it's kind of bleak. They're such a distinctive pop of color. It's really pretty.
The bandit's hearts are simple. A piece of white printer paper, 8.5 by 11, with a bright red heart in the middle. They're plain on their own, but Sierra says when you wake up to an entire city covered with them, it feels like magic. Add that the Valentine's Bandit has been able to keep their identity a secret for over 45 years, and you have yourself not just a local symbol, but also a local legend.
The annual Valentine Bandit.
Decades-old tradition.
An iconic red heart.
The closest thing we may have to a masked superhero.
Over the decades, the Bandit stunts have gotten bigger. In addition to the paper hearts, the Bandit started putting up big banners on notable Portland landmarks. Draped across the art museum, hanging from construction cranes, and atop Fort Gorges, an old military fort in the middle of Casco Bay, which is accessible only by boat. How did the Bandit even access these crazy places in the middle of the night? It added to the mystery.
It takes a lot of people out of the darkness of the winter. I had friends growing up who would do tours of downtown to see the hearts with their family. And my dad and I would always do that too, day after Valentine's, just see the work that was done the night before.
When Sierra was about 9, her parents told her they had a secret for her to keep. The Valentine's Day Bandit was her dad, Kevin.
And I thought that was so cool. Because I loved it. I thought it was such a special thing. It's like, my dad's in charge of it? That's awesome.
I used to get so worried about him. I never would sleep that night.
This is Sierra's mom and Kevin's wife, Patty Urban.
I don't know how many times he slipped and fell on the ice, dropped his iPhone off of the First Parish Church steeple.
For Sierra, it was fun having this secret that all of Portland didn't know. But it wasn't exactly surprising. Of course it was her dad. Her dad, who made her French toast with fresh fruit, or omelets, or blueberry pancakes each morning. Her dad, who was all about doing things for others. It made sense that he was the bandit.
I'm his only kid, and I came later in life, and I think he really latched on to me.
The minute she was born, I've never met anybody so committed to another human.
People say that the person he was before I came around and who he became after I came around, very different. I didn't know that it was such a drastic change until he passed.
Eight months ago, when Sierra was just 22 and her dad was 67, Kevin Farman died. It was very sudden.
That was a really weirdly typical night. He went to bed, and not 30 minutes later, Sierra came running down the stairs. And she said, "Mom, something's really wrong with Dad. You have to come right now."
I relive that day every single day of my life.
And I went upstairs, and he was unresponsive. And all I could say was, "No, no, 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 don't do this." And it happened anyway.
And then just life kind of fell apart from there, obviously.
The day after Kevin died, Patty says lots of family friends came to the house.
We were all just kind of sitting around talking about, what are we going to do? His friend Jane looked at all of us and she goes, we have to out him. And I was like, oh, whoa. And she was like, he deserves to be outed. It's time.
We never put it in the paper. We just released it to the funeral home. But it was on social media within 30 minutes. And in a couple of hours, it was crazy.
It was announced over the weekend that Portland's famous Valentine's Day bandit died.
Kevin never wanted recognition during his life, but his family wanted to honor him in his passing.
With that came the reveal of his identity.
And then from there, it got very overwhelming pretty fast.
Local businesses made Valentine's bandit pins and donuts, red hearts in enamel and icing. The governor of Maine posted a statement in Kevin's honor. In some ways, Kevin's sudden elevation to celebrity status was nice for Patty and Sierra, because it felt like the whole city was grieving with them.
It felt good for him to get recognized for something.
But it also felt odd that their personal tragedy, and the symbol that came with it, was so public. Strangers were using the heart as a symbol of Portland. Strangers who never met Kevin.
It is a little bit of a weird emotional thing. Yeah. And people are like have their own right to be so touched by it, but it is like, I don't want to say bittersweet, but it's like I'm protective of it as my own symbolism for my relationship with him.
It's not that Sierra wants ownership over the bandit or his hearts. The whole point of the bandit was to be for the community. As I was reporting the story, something big happened in a community just 45 minutes up the road. In October, Maine experienced a tragedy that impacted the whole state and, in a way, the legacy of the bandit.
From Lewiston, Maine, the scene of a horrific mass shooting here. At least 18 dead and at least 13 injured, several of them critically. And tonight, as we...
1 week after the shooting, I went to Lewiston.
You cannot talk to anybody, I can't anyway, in the state of Maine and have less than 1 degree of separation with somebody that was impacted by this.
That's Lisa Rodriguez, a longtime resident of Lewiston. We were chatting at the Tree Street Youth Center during an event called Love Lewiston Day. After the shooting, Lisa felt like she needed to do something.
I said, you know what I envision? I envision blue hearts all across the city, just like the Love Bandit in Portland. And that brings so much joy to people. And it really emphasizes love and care for our neighbors.
Lots of folks have come by today to pick up papers to post around town. Just days before this, Lewiston had been apocalyptically deserted. Now it's peppered with blue, bandit-style hearts. Something interesting is happening here. The symbol is evolving in real time. It's almost as if the symbol is alive. It's growing and changing beyond the hand of the artist. I asked Patty and Sierra how they feel about the heart symbol being used in a new way.
I don't think Kevin ever felt that it was all his. I mean, I just think he felt it belonged to Portland. He loved his community, and it was just, you know, Portland's gift. It's a gift.
It's been really cool to see that people are, like, taking the message that the bandit had and repurposing it. I mean, that's what my dad would have done.
What is going to happen to the Valentine's Bandit next year?
Clearly, it's impactful enough in the community that it can't just go away. Someone's going to do it. Mm. So I don't think it's a concern.
Are you going to do it?
I can't answer that question now, can I? That ruins the mystery. My dad never did it for the attention of it.
Even though it's 10 months after Valentine's Day, there are still red bandit hearts lingering inside shop windows across Portland.
I think there's something over here.
Oh, there's one.
Sierra and I walked around the city's old port together, looking for hearts.
There's another.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
They're literally everywhere. If you start paying attention, they're everywhere.
I asked Sierra if it's hard to see these reminders of her dad every day. She said no. It's almost the opposite. Every time she sees a heart in a store window or on a flag, she feels close to her dad again. There is his love for her, all across the city.
I'm happy to say that just a few months later, on the first Valentine's after Kevin's passing,
the city woke up covered in red paper hearts. This is Anissa in 2025 with a couple little updates. Sierra started a charity called the Farman Foundation to support organizations that her dad cared about. And Patty and Sierra released a downloadable JPEG of the official Valentine's Bandit heart in case you want to be a Valentine's Bandit in your own city. Okay, that's all for now. Bye.
Our next story is also about connection and how to find it on your own terms. When I was a SALT student and living in Portland for the first time, I discovered that this city is actually a small town. But even in densely populated southern Maine, where you're always scanning for familiar strangers around you, it can still be really hard to actually forge connections with people you don't know. This next story by Nick Nevis takes us inside a little micro community hiding in plain sight. And it's one that turns the tables on what it means to make a friend.
Do you feel like you can get to know someone just by playing chess?
No, I don't really know anything about people around here.
I've been coming to chess club here in Westbrook for a few months now, and I get this funny feeling.
Is your name Lee?
Lee, yes.
George.
Okay. By all counts, the chess players all behave a bit like particles of noble gas, sharing a container and bumping into each other, but never really connecting.
What's good about playing against George?
I pick him up in the morning to bring him over, so we always sit down and play the first game. Plus, it's fun. We've been playing for a long time.
How long?
What, George, 15 years? 10 years?
I think 20 years.
20, it could be.
Do you guys see each other outside of the chess place?
Mostly just chess. We haven't played outside of chess, outside of our Sunday morning club, but we may start.
Here, phone numbers are scarcely shared, and decades-long relationships never leave the chessboard. But the harder I looked, the more I felt myself asking if there was something deeper going on. How does community form around such a silent endeavor? Barry is in his 60s. He wears a baseball cap and has a beard that crowds around the edges of a blue surgical mask. We sit down to play a game of chess just as his friend Ruben has left to do his shopping in the grocery store behind us. To be clear, we are also in the grocery store, but Ruben is in the grocery part, not the chess part. We're in a cafe, sort of like how sometimes a Target is attached to a Starbucks, but in this case it's all just Market Basket brand. It's a couple booths, a big long table, an enormous, out-of-the-way TV that is either on Disney Channel or on ESPN, but it's always on mute. Just 10 paces from the checkout, chess players deep in thought flick the buttons on their chess clocks to indicate they've made their moves. Elite loiterers in a grocery store cafe.
Do you want to do this?
Sure.
I palm a pawn of each color behind my back and hold up my fists for Barry. He points at my left hand, and in that palm is a black pawn. He picked black, so I play white, so I go first. But before I go on, here are some facts about chess. In the 1900s, this math guy named Shannon sat down one snowy evening with like a tumbler of whiskey or something and decided it would be fun to figure out how many possible games of chess could happen. So he pushed up his nerd glasses and took out a paper napkin and a fountain pen probably and got to work. Much to the smug amusement of every chess player since then, he found that there are more possible games of chess than there are atoms in the known universe. Another fact is that, in my opinion, chess is the perfect game. Contained in the 64 black and white squares between me and Barry is 100 million universes, a branching tree as wide as the cosmos. And since Barry picked black, I play white, so I get to choose where that tree begins. Sort of a big responsibility. Barry unfurls a wrinkly chess mat, and we set up the pieces on the still-settling crests and troughs of the board.
Yeah, it'll eventually smooth out, I guess.
Yeah.
I make my first move, pawn to d4. In chess, the first couple moves is called an opening. Let's get a little technical. Chess is an old-ass game. People have been thinking about it pretty much since Joan of Arc finally gave medieval historians something to write about. Because of this, the first few branches of Shannon's tree are relatively well understood. Knowing an opening can have practical value, but they also have character and style, and they have names like the Budapest, or the Squirrel, the Accelerated Dragon. I try to open with the Queen's Gambit, but Barry's got other plans. Instead, he sets up what's called the King's Indian system, which is sort of like building a fortress early on in the game. It's an understated and dangerous opening. A couple of moves later, Barry is playing super aggressively. He brings out his most powerful piece, the queen, and I surprise him. He puts me in check, forcing me to protect my king, but instead of moving out of the way, I decide to trade queens, giving up my queen to take out his. This gory murder-suicide between the regents plays out with a light, surprised grunt on Barry's part, and I know I've caught him off guard. It's at this point that Barry's friend Reuben comes back from his grocery shopping.
Hey, Reuben.
Reuben is a thin, gray-haired, friendly but serious Russian man. Having missed the regicide, Reuben nonchalantly tells Barry about the new cheese options at the deli.
The farmer cheese is good.
Is good.
How long have you playing chess?
I've been playing for a while, but very, very casually. I never really studied very much until recently.
Did you go to chess club?
Not really, no.
Tournament?
No tournaments. No.
So you don't know even your rating?
I don't know.
At this, I start to get what I call the chess sweats. Reuben is clearly not expecting much from me. He probably walked over thinking, oh, is Barry playing against someone new and interesting? And then he sat down with his farmer cheese and realized Barry was playing against some unrated plebeian. To make matters worse, just then, I make what I can only describe as a plebeian mistake.
Oh, I can't
check there.
I try to laugh it off, but chess sweats keep flowing.
When you're over the board, you're like in a room and like the whole atmosphere is like more competitive and like professional.
This is Molly. She's in 8th grade and she's here on Sundays too.
And I feel like more people are watching me, so if I mess up, then it feels worse.
And to me, the worst part of making mistakes is that I feel like I'm letting Barry down, like not challenging him enough. In Lee's words,
It's two people creating puzzles for each other.
The more interesting the puzzles, the better the game. Win, lose, or draw. A few minutes passes, I try to come up with some decent moves, and Barry and Reuben make some small talk.
Reuben, 30 years ago, came from Russia, and everybody in Russia plays chess. Casually, for
not
blood.
Everybody. Everybody drinks vodka.
Everybody drinks vodka, plays chess.
Suddenly a set of moves comes into focus. I go for it.
You only have one rook, Reuben, and he's trying to take it. I should probably have made some better moves here.
But then, the game begins to take on a feeling of congealing, cement hardening inside a mold formed by the pawn structure.
My brain kind of feels like this board.
Sometimes that happens. Very difficult.
I move the few remaining pieces on the board around in my head, testing possible futures. To me, it feels a bit like straining to focus on something without your glasses, like looking out at a tree in the fall and squinting to make out the different colored leaves. And then I see it. Barry's plan. When your opponent hangs on as long as I have, the strategy shifts. Suddenly, your least valuable piece, the pawn, becomes the crown jewel. And Barry has a pawn that he can scoot right across the board.
I thought there was as a writer, I felt like there was a hidden gem in the story of chess.
This is Matt. He's one of the organizers for the chess club.
Where a pawn starts out at the one side of the board, and if they can make it all the way across the board, beyond travails and adversity, they can become anything they want. That's a story waiting to happen. You know what I mean?
I stubbornly maneuver my king in front of Barry's pawn to stop its progress across the board. But then we make a series of moves that feel both expected and inevitable, but ultimately still catches me by surprise. Stanley Kubrick pointed to just this sort of quality in chess as inspiration for his style of directing. A tiny horror movie playing out on a chessboard.
I wait for some idea like this.
Ah,
Okay. See, I saw the idea.
It was hard to avoid.
I couldn't see the back.
Tough to avoid.
Yeah.
Very hard with the three pieces. But.
I've lost to Barry a few more times since this game. We never do that much chatting, but our games have felt a bit like conversations in themselves. The chessboard always has new stories and lessons and riddles, even jokes sometimes. Whenever I come here, Barry and Ruben are always in the middle of a game of chess. They've been playing together for nearly as long as Ruben's been in the States, and Barry was one of Ruben's first contacts when he moved from Russia. Later, I sit down with Barry to chat, and I flip my recorder back on.
Have you, like, become friends with Ruben outside of chess in any capacity?
So, back in 1990, I was...
Barry starts to tell me about a computer class he taught, and how they became friends around that, but... Suddenly, Barry just, like, cuts himself off and abandons the thread entirely. And then he says...
Ruben is a very good person, very solid gentleman, very... search for the right word there, the polite and correct in his behavior on the chessboard. Not everybody is, but he bends over backwards to make chess an interesting game for whatever opponent he's playing. Unlike myself, who may, there's a way to crush this person with that move, and Ruben would play a stronger sometimes move that would enable that other person to rise up their game, where, I'm not like that, maybe. But so I learned things from that.
Could it be that in the infinitudes that Shannon saw was not only the vastness of a game, but a stage on which a friendship can take root and be nurtured? Either way, I'll likely be back at Chess Club next Sunday. If not for chess, then at least to get my groceries done. For the Salt Institute, I'm Nick Nevis.
Hi, it's Nick.
Nick called us with a quick update about what he's been up to since he finished making the story.
I moved to New York and I got to work at NPR and some of my favorite shows like Rough Translation and Invisibilia, and it's been a wild ride.
He says he's working on an MFA piece about Zen monks who are helping to lead people through the process of dying, which sounds really incredible. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard, I have really good news for you. There are even more Salt stories waiting for you at mainpublic.org/storytelling. And you can go there to find out more about Salt and more about Maine Public Radio. Episode 2 of this season features one of my all-time favorite Salt stories about a local reporter so dedicated to covering the issues facing Skowhegan, Maine.
You know, this really sucks.
That after losing his vocal cords, he fights to hang on to his voice.
I didn't give myself any choice.
By learning to use a small electronic box to talk again.
Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines.
You can listen to all of our Essential Salt episodes at mainpublic.org/storytelling. And while you're there, you can sign up for our new storytelling newsletter about the latest beautifully crafted, locally reported projects from Maine Public. Or drop us a line. We're eager for feedback and would love to hear what you think about Essential Salt and what you'd like to hear more of. I'm Jess Miller. Essential Salt is produced by Brenna Farrell, with help from Lucy Santerre. Thanks to Isaac Kestenbaum at Salt. Thanks also to Theo Balcom. Our executive producer is Susan Tran. Audio mixing by Steven Jackson. Essential Salt features original music composed by Q-Shop. You can find more music for storytelling at cue-shop.co. Support for Essential Salt comes from St. Mary's Health System in Lewiston, growing and evolving to best serve the needs of the community since 1888. Learn more at stmarysmaine.com.